from Nevada Public Radio. I'm Joe Shaneman. It's State of Nevada. In Clark County, the sheriff oversees a workforce of more than 6,000 people. They're there to oversee a jurisdiction that includes the state's largest airport, Reed International, the state's biggest economic engine, the Strip, and about half of the county's 2.3 million residents. The department's led by Sheriff Kevin McMahill, who took office in January of 2023. And as 2024 unwinds, the sheriff has some good news and some not so good news on the way. The good news is murder is way down. Not so good news, the department could be looking ahead to some financial headwinds it hasn't quite faced before. Sheriff McMahill, thanks for joining us again.
Good to see you again, Joe.
Good to see you too. So murder nationwide is down. The FBI reported in June that during the first quarter of 2024, homicides fell 26% nationwide. In Las Vegas, though, the decline is steeper. As of Sunday, 2 days ago, murders in Vegas numbered 54. That's less than 7 a month. And at this rate, Metro would have fewer than 100 murders by the end of the year. Metro reports online also say that violent crime is down almost 60%. Why? What is the department and its officers doing? What are they doing differently?
Well, I mean, the first thing I got to do is give credit to my men and women that are out there doing the job. They come to work every day to make a difference in this community. And you're right, our homicide numbers are down just shy of 20%. Robberies are also down 20% right now again. So some really good news on the numbers. But as I've talked about on your show many a times, I don't ever want people to forget that there's a name and a family member behind every one of those numbers, so they do matter. But I will tell you, we've been working a lot. You've heard me talk about this before, but doubling down on the community policing aspect of this, the philosophy is injecting humanity into all it is that we do. I have detectives that are just tenacious in following up on what is happening, as you've heard me talk about before. Solve rates in homicides are in the 90th percentile. Today we're sitting at about 94%. And so, but I would say that probably the biggest part of that is also the entirety of the agency approach to when a homicide occurs.
Well, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, I think everybody could understand that a patrol cop, a patrol cop working in the neighborhood is going to know the neighborhood better than any detective who doesn't work out there day in and day out, whether it's the suspects, the victims, the vehicles being used, the places that these things are happening. We make sure that we bring in those area commands and those officers also on those investigative aspects and utilize technology effectively.
Is that something different? Because in the movies, TV, you see homicide comes in, they take over, the cops are just there to, quote, secure the scene.
I think we did that for a while as well, but we really changed that culture at Metro. And I would say probably the last decade or so, we've really worked on making sure that everybody has a responsibility when a homicide occurs in our community.
Now, I understand that would help in solving a murder, but how does that help in preventing murders, or what's being done differently that way?
Well, I think they kind of go hand in hand, right? If you know you're going to get caught because you commit a murder in this town, I think it also has some psychological effect on those individuals that are doing this stuff. But as you heard me talk a little bit previously as well, you know, I'm working on what I'm calling a violent crime reduction team as we speak right now. And that's a number of officers that are going to go in and look at known shooters, people that have actually shot somebody. And the difference between somebody who survives and somebody who dies in one of these shooting incidents is sometimes just a matter of, you know, minute amounts of an inch, right?
Yeah.
And so what we do know is that we're less than 40% solve rate on those known shooter cases that don't ultimately end up in a homicide. And so what we're doing is putting together this shoot team to focus in on those individuals so that we can have that 90% success rate in incarcerating those individuals that are out there shooting individuals. And so I think that the question you're really trying to get to is the prevention aspect of this is so critically important, and doubling down on the community-based effort, developing that trust, things that you and I have talked about for well over a decade is beginning to pay off for us. I think we have a higher level of trust in our communities than we've ever had, and we're going to continue to work on that.
You have, for instance, in the past talked about gang shootings and retaliation. When a gang shooting happens and you want to prevent another murder due to retaliation, what are the things you do now that maybe weren't done in the past?
Well, I think we haven't done them consistently. I think that was the biggest problem was that Because these things take time, and you don't get the immediate gratification out of seeing the result of, you know, putting handcuffs on somebody or putting them in the jail. And so, you know, we just had a recent incident where an individual had been shot. He was in the hospital for about 4 months before he passed, and his family members had been involved in another shooting. And so we know that when one shooting happens, the retaliation happens, and the cycle never ends. And so we utilize pastors within our community, prominent members in our community, original gang members that have rehabbed their lives to go out and talk to those family members to stop the retaliatory shooting. And it works magic. It's amazing to watch. It's mentally and physically and emotionally draining, to be honest with you, because you're doing everything you possibly can to try to make sure that somebody else doesn't lose their life on your watch. And when it works, it's a really amazing thing to watch happen.
Well, let's talk then now about some of those headwinds I mentioned, or maybe we should call it a hurricane. And the background is this. Metro's budget is made up of some grants, but most of it's divided between Clark County and the city of Las Vegas. The city provides about 35% of Metro's budget. Clark County is about 65%. The city has some bad news on the budget front. They've lost a judgment to a developer that could cost them more than $500 million before it's all over. To make up for that, they are talking about cutting positions, for one, and who knows what else could be coming. And I'm wondering how worried you are about that because of the city's 860-something million-dollar general fund. That's not their entire budget. About $500 million of that goes to first responders.
How worried am I? I'm very worried about it. You know, we keep that two officers per 1,000 ratio. We're already below that as we sit here today. We're at 1.8. I'm not having trouble attracting people to our organization. In fact, we're one of only five agencies in the entire country that's under a 3% vacancy rate. But, you know, when the city doesn't have the ability to contribute to Metro's budget overall, obviously there's going to be some pain. This isn't the first time we went through pain. We did that when Sheriff Gillespie was here with the Great Recession. And, you know, we try to be very frugal with where we spend money and how we spend money. And there's a number of things that we're already talking about should the worst case scenario happen. But the idea here is to continue to have those officers out there on the street to make our community safe.
You know, earlier this year, Metro released numbers for use of force in 2023, and it was at a five-year high. The 10 shootings included 10 shootings of citizens, of residents, included four people who were suicidal. That was 0% the year before. There was also a 30% jump in allegations of abuse of force by police. What do you think is causing that increase?
I'm not really sure what's creating that increase. I will tell you that I think with the advent of fentanyl being inside of almost all the street-level drugs that are being taken out there today, we're seeing people that are a bit more off-kilter. You've heard me talk about mental health addiction and homelessness and the challenges around that. You know, we have these cases where we get called out by as the police to go to somebody who's suicidal, and then they choose to do the suicide by cop. And so we're taking a hard look at all of those things. I think the allegations are one thing and the end result is another. I don't see the significant increase in the cases that have been proven that our officers were acting irrationally. But I will also tell you that in all of those officer-involved shootings, the suspect was armed as well. And so, you know, that's one of the things, if you remember way back when, the police department, we had had a number of shootings of unarmed individuals that led to the DOJ review of us. And so, that, you know, I think we're one of the only agencies in the country that published the document that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to hide from there. It's a reality, and we have to continue to face what those trends are and make sure that our training is reflective for those individual officers that are out there, and then hold them accountable when they're making bad decisions.
Has anything changed in your practice of training de-escalation in officers? I mean, has that, as you try to hire more people, as you want to get people out on the streets, have you, I don't know, decreased the importance of that?
Not at all. No.
You know, and about the 10 people who were shot and killed in 2023, again, four who were suicidal, and they call, again, suicide by cop. You know, a year doesn't go by when an officer here or in nearby vicinities doesn't kill somebody who is suicidal. You say they were all armed. Sometimes they're armed with a knife. And we have talked about this before, and I know residents and people who aren't police officers talk about this. If somebody has a knife, why can't the officer just back away or wait for somebody else? Or sometimes you see officers unload their gun, shoot for the legs. You're going to hit one of the legs and down the person. Why do you have to shoot at center mass to kill?
Lots of reasons, Joe. Obviously, we have to be accountable for where those bullets go afterwards. And if you miss and you hit somebody behind the individual, then obviously we have even more of a problem there. But you're right. We did see a significant increase in the number of suspects with knives. De-escalation oftentimes is slowing the momentum, creating distance, having overwhelming numbers of officers there so that the individual may or may choose not to do something. There's a lot of stuff that goes into all that. It's not just simply the use of less lethal weapons and all of those kinds of things. It's an interesting point that you bring up, though, because just this week, I got an email from the union president who was asking me to seriously take a look at our response to what we call 405 or suicidal subjects. Because there's a push in California. There's a lot of small agencies in California that have chosen not to respond to an individual who's suicidal. And the reasoning behind that is that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has said that just because you're suicidal doesn't mean that you're committing a crime. And so when we show up and we use force against somebody just because they're suicidal to get them into custody, we can be held criminally liable for that. And so there's a lot of conversation around whether or not that's appropriate for us to do that. But I would say to you that in my mind, the appropriateness of that is to continue that sort of dual response model that we have mental health professionals that are going out there. Because my experience is that if somebody's suicidal and we know about it, there's a lot going on in their lives and there's a lot of help that needs to be provided to those individuals. And so I don't know that there's an easy answer to this one, but I also don't think the easy answer is to just simply turn your back on somebody who's calling up and requesting as much assistance as they can get because they're considering ending their life.
We have an email here from Andy who says, why is the hold time on 311 so long? That's the non-emergency police number. He writes, I've tried to get through multiple times for reporting non-life-threatening incidents, and after 30 minutes on hold, I give up! Exclamation point. We've talked about this before. I've been in that same situation. What is the situation with dispatch?
So, as you know, when I took over office, my dispatch center was only 50% staffed. Today, we're at 100%. I have not seen those 311 wait times as lengthy as what you've just described by your caller. And I apologize that you are waiting for that amount of time. But one of the things that we have to do better and what we're looking for technology here to help on is we can do some reporting by text. We can do some reporting by email. There's a number of different things, but everybody tends to use 311 as sort of the answer to all of the problems that they have in trying to get a hold of the police department. And so we've got to do a better job of educating people of when the right time to use 311 is. And also, look, the truth is there's just an overwhelming number of calls coming into the police department.
When is the right time? I've called 311 when I've seen drunk drivers on the road, people obviously swerving. And the dispatcher, I remember, this is years ago, you know, was very interested. It seemed like they wanted to send somebody. But is that a case where you should do it? Or I don't know.
Those are all times that you can call 311, absolutely. And, you know, there are those that will tell you that as the driving behavior gets worse as you're following behind a drunk driver, to stop following them because you're sort of pressing the action as you're following behind an individual. And so that conversation happens quite frequently as well. But the truth is I don't have enough cops for the amount of calls that come in the door. And so there's going to be wait times. That's just unfortunate.
I mentioned allegations of abuse of force by police. More than 200 allegations of abuse of force by police were in 2023. Of those, about 20 were upheld. And Metro's internal investigations, there is a citizens review board. But the ACLU has said in a newspaper article in the Review Journal that that board, which the ACLU's director has been a part of, is basically powerless. Do you think it's really fair for police to be judging other police? Hens guarding the hen house is the way some people would put it.
Okay, I didn't really understand your question, but
should you know, if somebody's accused of in a gang accused of bad behavior, should other gang members be the ones who are deciding if that person really did wrong? I'm not saying police are like,
Joe.
I'm just, well, you said you didn't understand it, so I wanted to make it clear.
It's a bad analogy, buddy.
I know. All right.
Yeah, I think our internal affairs process is extremely thorough. I think our look, we also have plenty of review. Also, Citizens Review Board does have the ability to review. Where the conversation has come in with the CRB is that oftentimes they don't like the level of discipline that is provided to the officers. And so there's a conversation that occurs in some of those instances. But the rules have changed so much since the CRB was created that we really don't have the ability to change that, because by the time discipline is decided, it goes to a board. I can't, as the sheriff, overrule what the discipline is when it goes to a board. And so there's conflict with us and the CRB in regards to that, and I understand their feeling on that. But I think they do a pretty thorough job also of investigating the cases that come to them.
Bruno from Summerlin is with us. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks, guys. A bit of a cold. I sound a little scratchy. Please indulge me. Listen, I've been listening with keen interest this morning, and I'm a little disappointed we have not discussed the homeless situation here in town. I want to share a quick story and ask a question. I had to go up to Reno the other day for business. I had to meet somebody at Reno City Hall. When I was in the downtown area, I didn't see one homeless person, not one. I didn't see one food vendor. I didn't see any of that stuff. When I spoke to the person with my appointment there, I said, what's going on with this? Where are all the homeless people? And they said, oh, we've got state money, and we built a bunch of shelters, and we have a bunch of federal programs from Senator Rosen and Cortez Mastro, and we've been able to get them out of our downtown area and out of most of the neighborhoods into shelters, and it's been working very well. So my question to you is, I do not understand with what Clark County, with the pull that it has in the legislature and with all the federal government, why is it, it seems like we're not making a dent in this issue at all. It blows my mind. Reno's not a hick town anymore. There's a million people up there. I didn't see one homeless person, one homeless encampment, some guys hawking chimichangas and frijoles and all that. What's going on with the homeless issue?
Great
Thank
question.
You for your time.
And you know, we have talked about this a lot in this program. What's Metro's stance on the homeless? If you see the homeless in a downtown area, homeless people camped out on the sidewalk, what does Metro do? And do you talk with the city and Clark County a lot about homelessness? I mean, they're very concerned about it. Businesses constantly are talking with the city and the county about it, how it diminishes their own business, impacts their business. Give me Metro's stance.
Yeah, Bruno, I think you have a great comment. I would just say to you that there's a lot going on when you talk about the unhoused population here in Southern Nevada. There's some really, really neat stuff that's happening in the county. The county's converted some old hotel rooms into sort of short-term rental beds for those individuals that are working on the sort of holistic approach and wraparound services. But there's a much larger effort coming forward, and it's a partnership between the Nevada Resort Association, the state government, the city, and the county to really put up a number of these centers so that we have an alternative to incarceration. Because as you've heard me say 1,000 times on this show, the incarceration doesn't fix the mental health, addiction, or homelessness. And that's the way we're going to continue to approach this, is more resources are coming in a very short period of time. And I'm actually very excited about where we're going to be able to go with
that. You said a number of centers. There has been a worry that the $100 million that the state is providing, provided that it's matched by the resorts, another $100 million, it's going to be more than just a one-stop shop in downtown someplace. But there are going to be outlets or satellites throughout the valley. Is that what you're hearing is going to happen?
Absolutely, yes.
That's interesting. We have an email here from Ken who says, we're already stressed with the diminished numbers of patrol cars while, I'm going to paraphrase here, as we see people speed and run red lights. And I think he's referring to the fact that you're facing these economic headwinds. I can see no good from reductions to our police force on the streets. It will only increase the number of tragic incidents at our intersections. Ken, thank you so much for that message. I want to get into another issue here. Last week, the Las Vegas Review-Journal had a story about Metro restricting access to press, even press briefings, by some freelance reporters. And you've often said you want to be the most transparent or more transparent than your predecessors. And increasingly, news outlets are using freelancers who aren't with legacy medias like local newspapers or Nevada Public Radio. What's going on there?
Yeah, I read the same story that you read there. I guess that there's sometimes when there's a press conference, there's individuals that they don't let in because they have credentials that are not from legacy media. I know the subject of that particular story now is, I believe he's part of a media outlet in Nye County, and so he has been allowed into a number of the most recent ones. But I also don't necessarily know if I agree with the fact that just because you claim that you're a journalist and that you have some online blog and you got a bone to pick with somebody, that that necessarily makes you legal media. So I'm still getting to the bottom of this. I'm trying to understand better what was reported, what our what our past actions have been, so that I can more effectively move forward on that.
I wonder as well if, you know, after the Ferguson, Missouri incidents and then the George Floyd incidents, there was a real focus on de-escalation throughout this country. And you and I had talked about it here. You were frankly disgusted by what you had seen happen in the videos in the George Floyd incident in Minnesota. Do you ever think journalists and the public should stop holding police officers' feet to the fire? Should they stop scrutinizing police? Or do you think that's good for police departments in general?
No, I think the media plays a very significant role in America as a whole, right? Also for elected individuals like myself and then public safety agencies like the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. I think they have a very significant role to play in what it is that's reported and not reported, because as you well know, there's people that have a tendency that they just want to do what it is that they do without having any media scrutiny on them. I welcome that scrutiny. It is what it is. Sometimes I think that there's people with agendas, no doubt about it, and you watch what those agendas are, and then you just wonder sometimes how we've arrived at that particular place. But journalism that's focused in on exposing things, I have zero problem with it.
We've talked on this program today, we got about 4 minutes left, about the decline in violent crime, the decline in murders. What's happening with nonviolent crime, theft, robberies, home break-ins, and that kind of thing? Metro did report car thefts are down 27.9% year to year compared to 2023. Robberies down almost 20%. Burglaries and breaking and entering are down 12%. What do you think is resulting in the decline? And I should preface this by saying, actually, that these sort of crimes happen more frequently. And when it happens to somebody, it feels much more personal. I mean, we're not all victims of violent crime, but just about everybody I know, myself included, has been a victim of some sort of break-in, either a car broken in, and it's a real violation of personal space. So what are you doing to increase the decline, to make it go down, and what more needs to be done?
Yeah, I've been a victim of a crime myself, Joe, and I completely agree with you. You've heard me talk about this before, but somebody breaks into your house, you feel completely violated, and that's a piece of safety in your heart that you're probably never really going to get completely back. And so, you know, when you look at auto theft as an example, 28% decrease in auto theft as we sit here today. My numbers are a little fresher than yours, but if you remember last year, we had that Kia TikTok challenge and the Hyundai TikTok challenge.
Yeah.
And we really took a lot of approach to that that was partnered up with the manufacturers of the automobiles and a number of different things to make it so that those cars were less capable of being stolen. We see a trend on the East Coast right now where they're utilizing these sort of receivers to capture the key fob that you have. And so they can go and walk up to a car and open that now. And so anticipate seeing some increases when it comes to that. But our ag assaults are down. Our stolen vehicles are down. The stolen guns being taken in residential burglaries are down. So the answer to your question is there's just a multi-pronged approach on every one of those crimes to figure out how do you target harden something. If we don't have the information because somebody chooses not to report it, we can't go out and get these individuals that are committing these crimes. So there's just a lot of good police work happening.
We have about a minute left, maybe a minute and a half. Then again, there was a story today about copper thefts in the Arts District. Some businesses were hit twice in a row, $100,000 in losses estimated. What could police do about copper losses, not just in the Arts District, but throughout the county where street lights on some streets are completely off because thieves steal the copper between these lights?
Yeah, so as you know, I started a construction theft detail. They work on the copper theft piece of this. We're also working both with the city and the county right now to create ordinances so that mere possession of that 7-strand wire that's being used in the lights that are along the freeway and on our roadways and in the parks and all of those places makes it illegal for somebody to have. There's also a lot of conversation with the industry about actually moving to the legislative process and sort of modeling something after like we did with the catalytic converters to reduce that. But you know, things like fingerprints and identification checks and all of these things that if we could make those required for you to go in and, you know, if you bring a box of 27 copper elbows in, we know they're stolen. You have to prove to us that they're not before the recycling centers can take them. And so we're on the right track with that.
We're going to have to wrap it up there. Kevin McMahill is the sheriff of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Sheriff, thank you so much.
Good to see you, Joe. Thanks.